This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/beyondbelief. I'm Ernie Ray, and welcome to Beyond Belief.
Water is a basic necessity of life. If environmentalists are to be believed, in 50 years' time we're going to have either too much of it, in which case we'll have flooding, or too little, in which case we'll all be very thirsty. The churches are adding their voices to the general disquiet. The Archbishop of Canterbury will give a lecture in October entitled Noah and the Flood, Lessons for the 21st Century. All religious traditions use water as a primary metaphor to express their fundamental beliefs. They've rituals associated with water. They wash with it, they drink it, they pour it, they sprinkle it on children's foreheads during naming ceremonies. So can they use these metaphors to speak to the folly of our ways and get us back on course? Join me to discuss the meaning and symbolism of water in faith traditions are Dr. Diana Lipton, lecturer in Hebrew Bible and Jewish Studies at King's College London, Professor Mary Gray, a Catholic theologian and the founder trustee of the organisation Wells for India, and Emma Restall Orr, head of the International Druid Network. Diana, what part does water play in your religious practices?
I'll tell you a story, not about my religious practices, but about one day I spent in Jerusalem about 5 years ago, which began and ended with water and had water in the middle also. I was walking in the Judean hills with two friends and we watched the sunrise and we came to a valley with a natural mikveh now used by Bratslava Hasidim.
A mikveh being a ritual bath
being a ritual bath for Jewish men and women. Men and women use the mikveh, and this, in fact, was used outdoors and would normally be used by men, but it was very early, there was no one around, and the three of us used the mikveh. And then we went to Hezekiah's tunnel, which is an 8th century BCE man-made tunnel that was created so that the city of Jerusalem could withstand the Assyrian siege at the time of Isaiah the prophet. Having walked through that tunnel, where, by the way, water still comes up to about your thighs and it's pitch dark the whole way through and you come out into the pool of Siloam. And after that, we drove to Caesarea, and by moonlight at the end of the day, we were bathing in the ancient port of Caesarea. That, for me, summed up water and Israel and Jewish tradition.
And a lot of that, Mary, you would relate to as part of the Hebrew tradition, is also part of the Christian tradition.
Absolutely. And I've also been through Hezekiah's tunnel and resonate very much with the kind of integral part that water plays in Judaism, and that we both go back to the creation stories, and water is very much part of that. And God saw that it was good. And I think right through the scriptures we share in common, that sense of water being so fundamental and so sacred is what we share.
Now, Emma, from a pagan druid tradition, how do you react to that story?
As a story from another part of the world, primarily. Let me quickly, briefly say two things. One is a ritual that we did, which was a peace ritual, just north of Bath, at Durham, in the rain, of course, in July in England, and then moved down to a spring, a lake, and we had one of our smiths had forged a bronze sword, a perfect reconstruction of something from the 6th century, and that was broken ritually and thrown into the water as a gift of offering of something sacred, that the water itself, which holds so much memory, which holds so much of our ancestral wisdom, our ancestral emotion, and the memories of the land itself, to cast this blade into the water was an act of offering, of sacrifice to the gods.
Now, those are very positive reactions to Diana's original story, but there is a negative side to water. Certainly within the Jewish tradition, water is very often associated with destruction as well.
It's true. And of course, the primary story that we think of is the flood. Yeah. But I think it's very important to see that even where water destroys, as in the flood, there's also a healing aspect of it, that the destruction and the healing are built in, both of them. So in the end, the flood destroys things that weren't tenable anymore on the earth, but it also heals the earth and makes it possible for a remnant to continue and to live again. So even when water is at its most destructive, there's always the potential for new life.
And what's very interesting is that the symbol of Noah's flood and the symbol of Noah is being resurrected today as a kind of climate change struggle. We have Operation Noah as part of Christian Ecology Link, and people are launching arcs on the Thames to make a focal point about respecting water and action on behalf of climate change. So Noah's alive and well.
Well, I want to come to the ecology in a moment, but Mary, if I were to ask you to tell a story that reflects the sort of Christian tradition and the meaning of water in that tradition, what would you say?
I'm going to bring you to an ashram early in the morning, and we're in the Thar Desert, north of Jodhpur, in the second poorest state of India, Rajasthan, semi-arid, the thick of a five-year drought. Early in the morning, we're having a prayer service which is largely Hindu, partly Buddhist, partly Islamic. And we Christians are kind of dozing off a bit because it's 6 a.m, listening to the sounds of Om Shanti, Om Shanti. And suddenly the leader stops and he looks at us and he says, "Now, normally we'll have the teaching of Gandhi here, but because you're here, let's have Jesus." So we shoot up, wake up, you know, teachings of Jesus, water, water in the desert. And suddenly you find it streams out of you, Jesus saying, "I am the living water." And the whole kind of sense of water being cleansing, healing, and bringing life. And I think that's the most important point, bringing life. And we said to them, we believe that, that if we respect the principle, water brings life, life will come back to these desert villages and people will hold their heads up again and there will be laughter and joy returning. And they loved it.
Emma, I'm interested in that because I think you mentioned earlier that water and the experience of water to you is very connected with where we are living. Britain is an island. And that experience in an ashram in India would be completely different from how you might interpret water, I suspect.
Exactly. The rain here in Britain. We complain about the rain all the time. But the rain provides such a rich, fertile, green, wealthy country, islands for us here. And I was watering my garden with the water from the water butt that comes from the rain, and the rain's coming off the ocean, the Western Ocean, and falling over the garden, over the roof. And I'm watering my vegetables with this water, and my water butt empties, and I have to then use the tap to water the food that I'm going to eat. And that disconnection, that very clear shift, profoundly acute recognition of the relationship of water, of locality, was very powerful.
Diana.
That really resonates very deeply with something in the Hebrew Bible, in the Hebrew Bible Old Testament. There's a contrast between Egypt, where everything is watered by the Nile, and everything is fertile and rich and comes, and Israel, where the land of Israel, where that can't happen, where the water is just from the rain and you can't expect it and you can't control it. And it's a gift in that sense. And the contrast with location is very profound.
It's interesting thinking about the Nile, actually. The word, the goddess of the Thames, Tamasis, the etymology of that goes to the dark flood. The Thames is that dark flooding river. Mm. Of course, it's held now within the confines of what we allow the city to be. But that dark flood is the same as the Nile and very, very deeply a part of our heritage here.
It's true also that in your tradition, water is seen as the place of the dead in some sense.
It is. In some ways, we do think of it as the place of the dead, partly because we are here, out here, we think of ourselves on the edge of the world. If you think about it, looking back 10,000, 12,000 years, here we are on the edge of the world with the great Western Ocean. That's where the sun sets. And we have this feeling within paganism of you die with the setting sun and you are reborn with the rising sun in the east. The dead take their journey with the setting sun into the ocean to be reborn again.
Mary.
We do actually mesh with the Celtic traditions in Christianity. You said the rain falling in our land. And of course, where the Atlantic winds came, thousands of wells sprang up. Mm. And originally, they would have been guarded by Celtic spirits.
Absolutely.
And then when Christianity came, Christian saints would take over.
Yes.
So you have, and often female saints,
yes,
like the mother of St. David, St. Non, was the caretaker of a well, Bridget of Ireland, and
absolutely,
so on.
Yeah.
So I like to think there you've got a deep connection between women and water, and women responsible for finding water. And I think that's common also with you, Diana.
There's a wonderful rabbinic tradition based on something in the Book of Numbers, which was that for the whole time that the Israelites wandered in the wilderness, a well followed them, and that was the well of Miriam. And when Miriam died, the well dried up. And now some feminists, and others too, I expect, have a tradition of, at the Passover Seder, of having not just the cup of Elijah, which is traditional and filled with wine, but a cup of spring water, which is called the cup of Miriam and symbolises that well.
Very interesting to see the common currents floating around here. But why are rivers considered sacred? Why do rivers occupy such a prominent place in the sort of imagery of religions?
In paganism, there's a wonderful difference between the rivers that flow west and flow east, and I'm particularly talking about in the British Isles, where so many do flow west or east. The Thames, Tamisus, flows east. The Severn, Sabrina, and all the rivers that flow into the Severn goes west. And they have very different qualities, very different gods associated with spirits and purposes as well. So people find that they are drawn to live along the rivers that flow into those flowing east or those that flow west. And when you move from one to another, life changes in different ways.
Well, let me remind you that you're listening to Beyond Belief, and today we're discussing water. It occupies a central place in the imagery of all the great religions. But have they shown equal concern for the politics of water and for the impact of those politics on environmental issues? And with me are Emma Restall Orr, Mary Gray and Diana Lipton. One of the largest of all the world's religious gatherings takes place on the banks of a river. The river Ganges is holy to all Hindus. As a very small girl, Mamta Bhatia was taken by her family from their home in Britain to experience the religious call of the Ganges. I asked her to explain the importance of rivers for Hindus.
Rivers are important to Hindus because they were born from gods and religious times that are documented in our holy books, the Gita, and the religious story, the Ramayana. So they're born out of episodes in our history and our culture. They represent gods and holiness and purity.
Now, you were only 4 when you first went to the Ganges. Tell me about your first memories.
I remember it being really hot and very, very busy, and lots of different people there pushing each other to try and get into the Ganges. My mother was holding onto my hand so she wouldn't lose me, and I was holding onto my brother so he wouldn't lose him. And, you know, there were all sorts of animals, massive tortoises that I remember coming towards me, jars and clothes, and, you know, the water was murky, murky brown. It was very busy. It was quite an experience.
Must have been almost overwhelming for a 4-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely it was. The vibe, the atmosphere was quite electric, actually. And so that made it okay. Looking back, as weird as it was for a 4-year-old coming from the UK, it made it okay because everyone was there, you know, in good spirits, therefore, you know, a religious purpose to gain purity.
What does the water of the Ganges symbolise for you?
I do know it as holy water, but obviously growing up and reading about the pollution and actually seeing the pollution, I'm a bit tentative about, you know, whether I'd go there again and bathe in the water. Back in the UK, when we are undertaking religious events, maybe a wedding or, you know, a funeral or a religious blessing in the home, we will always present holy water and we'll always take holy water, which means we will take some in our palm and we'll drink it to ensure we are pure enough for that ceremony. So for me, it will always be religious and it will always be special. But whether I go and bathe in that water is another thing.
Just describe the extent of the pollution. Just how dirty is the Ganges?
The Ganges is considered one of the dirtiest rivers in the world. If you think about the amount of people that come and bathe in the Ganges, where they're coming from, I mean, it has lots of different germs. People come to the Ganges to let go of the ashes of loved ones. So it contains ashes as well, contains jars, clothes as well. If you take part in a funeral or you have a loved one, you will dispose of their clothes in the Ganges. So the pollution is really bad and the population has grown and the main points around the Ganges, so Rishikesh, for example, Uttarkash, Gangotri, are a few areas where, you know, in the 1970s there are only a few huts with sadhus, religious people staying in them. But now that, you know, there's apartments, they're overpolluted, it's an incredibly busy area.
And there's an irony in that because here's this water that's supposed to have cleansing properties and it itself is unclean.
Absolutely, absolutely. What happens is every Hindu household has bottles of holy water. We call it Ganga Jal, so Ganga from Ganges and Jal meaning holy water. It's supposed to represent the most pure water that never goes off, that never smells. You open a jar and actually it does smell quite pure, but going there, I think, and experiencing it is a different experience. It's a different experience.
So to what extent do you think that the sacredness of the river, which brings people to it to bathe in it, to what extent is that responsible for the pollution?
I think to a large degree, actually. People go from all over the world to do these things, sacred Hindus. Of course, it will definitely impact on the pollution that there is today.
I'm going to push you. If you went there again, would you bathe in the Ganges?
Probably in a diving suit, yeah.
But you wouldn't drink it?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't now.
That was Mamta Bataya. Mary, there's a parable there. The source of life has become a polluted stream.
Absolutely. It's quite tragic because I very much resonate with what she says about the huge respect and reverence for the Ganges. I don't think we have such a similar parallel in Christianity. I was trying to think when she spoke, and of course Jesus' baptism in the River Jordan has given that a kind of sacred symbolism. I think the only parallel I can see is the sense in which people flock to sacred shrines like Lourdes and take the waters and bathe and think of it as a place of healing.
Would it affect your idea of Jesus' baptism if the River Jordan had been a filthy sewer?
I don't think so. I think it's more like a filthy sewer now. It's a kind of muddy puddle now, I think, the Jordan. And that's, of course, part of the tragedy we're discussing here, the whole sense of what's become of the sacred rivers.
And Emma, would it matter to you if the waters that you used in one of your rituals was actually polluted?
If the waters were polluted, the ritual would be focused upon the pollution. Mm. The waters hold stories. So whenever we use water, we are aware of the stories that are within it. So if you're using water from a stream or rainwater from a water butt or water from a tap or water from a particular river or the sea, those stories are very specific. You can feel the energy is totally different.
But my point is, you can surely also feel that the energy is different if you've got a handful of polluted water.
It is. But we need to respond to that as opposed to just dismiss it. The stories of the pollution are there, and they demand a response. They demand us to act in response.
Diana.
I wonder if we're being unrealistic, though, about the water. If this is water where people go to be purified, as in many other rituals, in the temple, for example, that was the case, people went to remove sin, that in fact the sin or the impurity or whatever they're going to deal with will then, the water will be a vehicle, will be a vessel for that. And it's sort of hard to, well, I suppose in a miraculous mindset, you can have something endlessly being clean while absorbing sin. But maybe we need to have a more organic thought process about what we're expecting of water and how it can function in that way.
Mamta's point, a very interesting point about the sacredness actually being the cause of the pollution. It must be disturbing for people who hold both religious traditions and water dear, Mary.
Well, it is very disturbing, but I think that we have to acknowledge our responsibility for causing that pollution. I'm thinking, if we're talking about rivers, I'm thinking of the rivers of the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia, which is in a dire situation. Australia's just drying up.
Yes.
And I think that the late in the day, perhaps, the Catholic hierarchy are actually facing up to that sort of challenge. And the bishops of Australia have produced a document called The Gift of Water, where they acknowledge our failure to respond to the need to limit for right usage and so on. And I think that's a much more realistic kind of response and a necessary one, given the severity of the situation that we're all facing now.
I think I'm right in saying that the last Pope, John Paul II, made precisely one speech about ecology in the 23 years of his pontificate. It seems to me quite clear, religious traditions have been notoriously slow to pick up an environmental concern.
Well, can I defend him? I mean, it was 1990 on World Peace Day, January the 1st, and he talked about peace and reconciliation with the earth. I think there is one more speech, actually. But more to the point, Pope Benedict, July the 18th, 2008, talked about the right to water based on the dignity of the human person and called for clear international policies to safeguard water and the world's resources.
How quick have Jewish people been to pick up on ecological concerns, Diana?
Earlier, when you spoke about if Jesus had been baptized in a polluted Jordan, well, that's something that I think in Israel and elsewhere, but very much in Israel also, people are aware that it's not enough to just have the symbolism of water and rivers and the role they play, but we must take an active interest also in not having them be polluted.
Mary.
Part of my worrying about what's happening to our water sources and the danger of water wars and water conflicts says, well, maybe the whole point about being human is our agency and our responsibility. You know, moving huge rivers from one place to solve the water problems in another place. How do we solve the problems even in our water harvesting in India? We get water flowing, but that means are the people downstream very upset because we may have taken water from them? I don't think so, but because I think we're increasing the water sources.
But it does bring up a point of theology, because Christians and Jews believe that God has given them dominion over the earth, stewardship over creation.
Yes, which we don't even comprehend.
Yes. I think our later thinking would dispute that. In Christian ecology, we are very conscious of the fact of what damage we've done by saying we have dominion or we have domination. And we try to kind of re-look at that text in terms of responsibility in the way I've been speaking.
One of the key texts in the whole environmental movement, in fact, possibly one of the primary texts, is Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. When was it? 1962. She was talking about pesticides and DDT. And how they destroyed the insects, which then destroyed the birds, and that's what makes the spring silent. They're no longer the songs of the birds. The silence of the birds because of what mankind has done, I think, is really important.
I mentioned in my introduction the politics of water, and just to give one illustration, I think somebody's already mentioned Egypt and the way that the River Nile waters the land of Egypt. Again, the irony is that the Nile, of course, doesn't rise in Egypt. Part of the politics of water, the Ethiopians have now threatened that they may create dams that will cut off the supply of water to Egypt. And Egypt has said that this could lead to war. So the politics of water become politics that can actually lead to huge conflict, Dan.
Well, that's quite the case in present-day Israel also. There's something called the Stockholm Water Prize, and actually a recent winner of it is a colleague of mine, Tony Allen, from King's College London. One of the things that he works on and he got his prize for is the concept of virtual water, where we can't just think about how much water when we turn on the tap or water crops and so on, but every single thing we buy, wear, eat, do represents a certain amount of water that's gone into producing that. Once we start thinking that way in our global economy, the idea of controlling water in one place or another and not understanding that this is something that really transcends borders.
But we've all drunk water out of plastic bottles, I suspect.
But that's a choice we each make, and that's a choice we each should be making more consciously. Mm. We each are responsible not just for what we do, but for how we express what we think is right. Mm. Druidry is not an evangelical religion, but I'm afraid I am as an environmentalist, profoundly evangelical.
Absolutely. I think we have to be. If we think about the sort of crops that are grown in different places and inappropriately, water-hungry crops in places which have no water, trying to find water by huge dam schemes funded by the World Bank and so on, when the answer that many of us think who work in this field is that it's small-scale water harvesting based on the local resources and so on, which is the answer.
I think there's been a slight washing of hands on the part of the religious lobby here. I want to get back to my original point that religions have been notoriously slow to pick up on environmental issues. It was part of the problem that there was a suspicion that all this environmentally friendly stuff was sort of tinged with, forgive me, Emma, paganism. There's a sort of a fear of syncretism, of dabbling with druidry and paganism that put, certainly I think, the evangelical movement off getting involved for many, many years. Mary.
I just think you're right. I think within the Catholic tradition, though, we've been able to build on the sacramentalism and the sacredness, and that's where I could link with you. We haven't had to try so hard. But where we do have to try, and this is where I think it's not only being wishy-washy, sorry, about sacredness, it's about getting some kind of strong ethical commitment, and that's where I think we have to draw on other traditions.
But I think one of the important things here is about not abstracting, not being conceptual about it, actually getting down, which is what you're so beautifully talking about, actually getting down and getting dirty, getting muddy, getting involved. When we think about it theologically, and I say for my own religion as well, when we think about anything theologically, when it's all up in the head, we can be very clear and very proud of our ideas, but not actually change what we do, walk just the same road and make just the same mistakes.
Diana.
In a sense, I think it's our responsibility now to develop a new religious symbolism of water where we can more easily address with it these environmental concerns. And I think some groups, speaking within Judaism, there are groups that are attempting to do this, but it's very slow to change the symbolism of something as predominant as water.
It's very interesting that religions now are being targeted by the World Bank and the UN to help on water issues, Mary.
Well, it is very interesting, and we had a very interesting conference of Alliance for Religion Conservation, which actually tried to bring together the faiths with the World Bank, UNDP, Habitat, DFID, and so on, and with the innovators, the technology people who thought they had the technology to kind of change things. And from the agencies like the World Bank being fairly sceptical, there was a kind of breakthrough to, in fact, a UN-led decision to saying when a policy would be made, they would consult the faiths. And that's going to start in the autumn.
Well, I'm really struck by the degree of consensus there is around this table about the place of water in our traditions and what we need to be doing about it. I would like to set each one of you a challenge before we end this programme. I'd like you briefly to try and persuade a sceptical world that your tradition's understanding of the spiritual significance of water is important, Diana.
I resist the idea of persuading anyone to engage with the world through my religious lens or anyone else's. If I had to, I would suggest the ubiquity of water and its applicability to almost every area of life, its healing powers, its powers of transformation, the hope it gives, its identification with God, with Torah, with understanding, but also with danger, with reverence, with fear, with something we must take responsibility for ourselves and that can affect us negatively as well as positively.
Emma.
The rivers are so sacred to us. They guide us, they teach us about flow, about what comes to us and what we must let go of, about what we carry and what is carried through nature and how we are a part of that carrying force. And that, I think, is fundamental within paganism. Listen and move, let it flow.
Mary?
Well, I think I want to take these sceptics to villages forgotten by the rest of the world in desert states, to get them to see that where you hold water sacred, where it makes a difference between life and death, then you can be inspired to make a commitment to live differently, to respect limits, not push our consumption of water beyond what the sources can cope with, so that we may avert the peril which we are told is coming quite soon.
Well, that's all for this afternoon. My thanks to Diana Lipton, Mary Gray and Emma Restall-Orr. I'll be back again next Monday when I hope you'll join me.